Hello and welcome to the latest Bruin podcast, where we return to the subject of US equities, though this time in the company of Claire Hart, a fund manager from JP Morgan. Now, the content today looks at credit conditions in the US banking sector. You know, where is the loan growth and where are the pockets of anxiety? Then we turn to the political hot potato that is drug pricing before rounding out with an early speculative assessment of the prospects for the US presidential election late next year. You know, what could be the consequences of a Democrat victory for markets? And will Trump even run? And here is a comment from our guest on that very topic.
There is a little bit of conspiracy theorist inside of me that says that maybe the Republicans actually figure out a way to get somebody else to be up there instead as a candidate.
Okay, for more on all of this content, please keep listening. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Bruin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Bruin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Head of Fund Research, and we're delighted to welcome Claire Hart, Lead Manager on the JPM US Equity Income Fund, over from the States, exclusively to join us on this podcast. Claire, how are you? Thanks very much for coming over.
I'm well, thanks.
Great. So we're here to talk about US equities in the main, but I think we wanted to look at a few issues more specifically relating to the positioning within your strategy. You know, there's lots of other things going on in the fund, but certainly there's a banking position in there and a healthcare position. So I think we want to just look at credit conditions in the US, to what extent the earning, and what that means for the earnings outlook for banks. Think about drug pricing, clearly a hot topic in the US, and given the political backdrop, and what that means for the earnings power of your healthcare exposure. And then maybe we'll talk a little bit about politics at the end if we have time, because I know it's very early in the cycle, in the political cycle. But, you know, Democrats are trying to find their candidate, and to what extent the Democratic policy mix may be a threat to the businesses that you're investing in. So let's start with the banking sector and credit conditions. You know, banks are, you know, there's auto lending, there's student loans. Of course, there's mortgages, there's commercial loans to corporations. I just wanted to get your assessment of what the growth is like and the quality of that loan book is in those sort of various sectors, and then areas that may be concerning and areas that are more prosperous.
Okay, so I would say sort of overall, you know, loan quality is good. There's decent demand and losses are not running high, right? So losses are actually still quite low in the loan book. So, you know, on the margin, you look at it and think, okay, well, so where could the risk be, right? Where could the losses get worse? A couple of sectors that you mentioned that do sort of pop out that people are watching: auto and student lending. Auto lending is worse in terms of sort of the credit within auto is worse. And also student lending is not, it's not as bad as auto, but it's definitely an area that people are watching. And so I would say the good news about that is that neither auto nor student lending is actually large parts of the book for most of the banking sector, and certainly for the banks that we have. And it's quite granular. So it's not similar to sort of the subprime crisis in that it could sort of percolate and spiral out of control. There, again, auto and student lending is relatively small and granular loans. And so worth watching, but shouldn't be a huge issue for our banks. I would say the other thing
credit cards.
I was going to move to that next. So that's sort of an area that I think is worth watching, because that's actually weakened a bit. I kind of as expected, perhaps, because the credit quality there has been running quite well, right? Strong. I guess that, you know, the thing worth watching is, it's interesting to me because consumers, for the most part, they are working. Unemployment is relatively low. Wage growth is relatively strong. But, you know, credit quality had been running again, very healthy for a long time. And so it's sort of as expected, but it's something worth watching, especially because a lot of small businesses, for example, start their life with individual business owners taking loans out on their credit cards. So it's something that we're keeping an eye on. Of those three, those are sort of the three sectors. And then mortgage lending is fine. Mortgage losses are not running dramatically high or low. There's some subtleties going on in the U.S. markets related to states like California, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, with additional, you know, real estate taxes not being deductible and that sort of thing. So that's actually putting a bit of a damper on those housing markets. And those are high-priced housing markets. And so, but other than that, other than those sort of small regional issues going on overall, it, you know, it's healthy. Mortgage market's healthy.
So why wouldn't mortgage originations be running higher than they are with employment so strong in the US market? You would have thought maybe this would have been a real boon to banks, or maybe it has been, but it hasn't run necessarily as hot as one might have hoped.
Well, it's a couple of things. So I would say mortgage rates now are actually, they are creeping higher, first of all. I mean, most people get a 30-year fixed, and that number's been moving up a little bit. And even adjustable rate mortgage, the interest rates have been moving up a little bit because the Fed's been moving. So it's not as cheap as today as it had been, let's say, in the past. But then beyond that, what the banks are not doing is loosening their credit standards. So that's good for me as an investor in the banks because I don't want to see them loosen their credit standards for mortgage borrowers. But if you're a mortgage borrower, it's not good news for you. And what I'm really talking about is sort of the FICO scores that the banks look at. So people might be earning a little bit more money, but if it's not enough to actually move their FICO score, and depending on who that person is with a job, they still might not have enough income to qualify for a mortgage. And so I guess my point is, even though we're seeing healthy wage growth and unemployment's low, that might not intersect with or cross over into, okay, things are so good now that you can actually get a mortgage and buy a house. That's probably the way to think about it.
Okay. And then on the corporate side, we sort of do see that an area of concern may be leverage in the US corporate sector. I mean, to what extent are banks playing their part in that, and to what extent are they concerned about that?
We haven't seen outsized losses. And I would say, you know, banks are, I think, appropriately pricing for the risk. And so I personally think it's kind of the wrong time for a company to be levering up dramatically to do a transaction or investment unless they are really confident about their cash flows in sort of good times and bad. And so I don't think the banks are not loosening credit standards per se either. But I would also say there's probably not as much M&A as that I would have expected at this point in the cycle, even though rates are low. And so I think part of that is not because companies don't want to do things, but some companies can't actually get the debt to do a transaction that they'd like to do.
So, I mean, just before we aggregate all that together to get some sort of sense of where you think, sense of confidence in the earnings outlook for these businesses, I mean, to what extent do your banks that you lean into, do they have this sort of FICC account, this other side of the equation, which is sort of lots of sort of fixed income trading and other more sort of spurious balance sheet type work that does, you know.
We don't have, you know, so for example, we don't invest in the, you know, people like Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs. I mean, that's kind of where you
yeah,
get
sure.
the, I don't invest in those. And again, those are not expensive. Morgan Stanley actually has a bit more asset management now, certainly more than Goldman Sachs. But it's, you know, it's FICC, but it's FICC trading. And so it's hard, when I look at some of those businesses, it's hard to stick a multiple on that because by the end of the day, you know, everything zeroes out and the next day they show up and they have to do more trading to generate. So it's, you know, it's earnings that don't deserve quite as high a multiple. But our banks do, you know, they talk about sort of mortgage lending broadly speaking, but they all have sort of other fee-based businesses. So it could be asset management, could be, you know, for BB&T, for example, they have an insurance, one of the largest insurance brokerages inside their bank. So there are other business lines in there that can generate fees other than just lending. And that's the ballast. That's the ballast and also the granularity. We're talking about auto, student lending, all these different business lines, middle market, small market lending. That's the ballast that, you know, if one part's not working, they can go someplace else to find a place to invest the deposits that they have to make money.
So let's think about that earnings and that earnings growth expectation in context of the market and also, you know, the valuation that is ascribed to those earnings that have sort of clearly made offer some appeal to you.
So I think the valuations on the banks are not high, and they're forgiving. And so, you know, people talk about, you know, different parts of the market, what's the market trading, all that sort of thing. I think the banks have, when you look at their earnings expectations and the outlook for the banks, they're reasonable, they're not inflated, and the multiples are not high. I look at other parts of the market where I feel like the multiples are high and the earnings expectations are inflated and hopeful. And so, again, when people feel like, you know, the stocks will just go up 30% in any given year because the earnings will be up 30%, people don't bother to look at the banks. But I think in reality, if you know, pen to paper, you can pencil into what a bank really can earn, plus or minus a little bit, over the course of the year. And having that certainty around the earnings, I think it really makes a difference in an environment where, again, I think some multiples are sort of a bit frothy.
It's interesting you use the adjective forgiving, mm-hmm. Or verb forgiving, because, yeah, and that suggests there's some caution that you may have about, you know, if for example, you know, some businesses miss their earnings,
yes,
then banks have a little bit more of a cushion, do you think, to weather that relative to some of those sort of higher priced tech stocks?
Oh, I mean, I do think so. And too, I mean, if you think about it, just structurally, when a bank misses earnings, you know, maybe the top line is a little less robust, or the net interest margin, the NIM that people talk about, is off by a couple of basis points. You know, so the bank will go up or down a little bit, you know, as long as it's not a body blow, meaning like there's a huge loss on the book that people didn't expect on the bank. The banks don't fluctuate as much. Now, you move out of the tech sector and you take a name that's not growing, instead of growing at 35%, it's growing at, you know, God forbid, 25%. You will hear a crushing sound in that multiple. And again, 25% top line growth would be stunning. You'd be very excited about that. Unless, of course, people were expecting 35%, right? And so that you don't see that sort of fluctuation on the bank's earnings streams. And so you don't see that kind of volatility in the share price as you do for that 35 to 25% air pocket that we're talking about in other parts of the market.
Okay, right. Well, let's move on to another part of the fund. You know, healthcare sort of sits large in terms of your sector mm-hmm. exposure. Clearly, there's many different strands to healthcare. I mean, which areas do you tend to favor? And I guess we're sort of interested. Well, which areas do you tend to favor?
Mostly the pharmaceutical names, and then some of the device, you know, device companies, consumables, so to speak. And where we don't really shop, but I think we might have an opportunity over the course of this year, next, as we kind of move into the elections, as you alluded to, managed care. So we don't have exposure there, but I think those names could be interesting. They tend to come under pressure when people talk about, you know, depending who might get elected, if there's universal healthcare. And I don't think we're moving towards sort of an NHS model, universal healthcare, broadly speaking, or Medicare for all is something else that people talk about it, call it that in the States. But whenever there is a suggestion that we might be going that way, the managed care names that obviously sell insurance policies to individuals come under pressure. And so, again, because I don't think we're going to wind up with a universal healthcare system in the United States, I'm watching that managed care sort of sector, subsector, for an opportunity to maybe buy one of those names for the portfolio. So that's an area where we're not. I might, but I could see us winding up. And then within the pharmacy names, that is where we have most of our exposure. What I've been doing is we've actually taken some money out and we're rotating money around. And it really gets, you know, a couple of things. You hear there's lots of discussion in the States about drug prices and how high they are. In reality, there's lots of food, you know, lots of sort of hands in the pot, so to speak. Like, it's not just the pharma companies charging outrageous prices, and that's the problem. The pharma company come up with a drug, and then you start layering the people, the middleman in. You layer in the hospital that wants to add on a surcharge. You layer the doctor adds on a surcharge. You layer the pharmacy that delivers the drug at the local, you know, local drugstore around the corner adds in a price. So there's lots of additional expenses and middlemen in there between what the pharma company charges for the drug and what the consumer pays for it at the end. The problem is it's opaque and everybody's pointing fingers. And so I feel, you know, quite strongly the pharma companies are the ones that do the R&D. They actually come up with the patents. They create the drug. They take the risk and they create the drug. And they don't get 100 cents on the dollar. They get closer to maybe 58 or 60 cents on the dollar. The other 40 cents that disappears, that's where I don't want to be right now. Because eventually, as there's more light put into this sort of subsector in terms of drug delivery, I think there's going to, you know, there's some bad actors and they're collecting money for not doing much. And I don't want to be exposed to those names.
So have the pharmaceutical companies, you think that 60 cents on the dollar is a pretty robust sort of ratio that they can count on, or do you think there are any threats to that nonetheless?
Well, I think there's, I mean, I'm giving a very high headline number that I got from one CFO, right? So every CFO might talk a different number for their book, but broadly speaking, I think that's probably a good rule of thumb for the industry. But there are certain drugs that, you know, within oncology, for example, that's an area where I do think drug prices overall are probably going to come under pressure. And part of that is, you know, there's several drug companies that can actually come up with oncology solutions, yet the prices seem to stay high. And I worry that there could be competition. You know, for China, for example, you know, is coming up with interesting drugs for oncology. I don't feel that those drugs will come to the U.S. market, but to the extent that it becomes obvious that in China, certain drugs are a lot less expensive than they are here, I think it will put pressure on some of the drug companies to sort of collectively bring down price, especially if our government is already looking at what other countries pay for drugs and services. And then they bring that home to our drug companies to say, we really think you should work on pricing.
So the seeming sufficient presence of competition in a domestic market is not...
It's not policing not, as
not,
much
not,
as it...
Not bringing about the competitive level of pricing you might have hoped for. So maybe an international threat of international inclusion may get them moving a bit faster.
I think that's what the FDA is hoping. I do think it's a threat, though. That's a good word, because I think it's a threat, and I do not see it happening. But it's out there. And so that, I think, could... And again, there are some drug companies more exposed than others. And so, you know, in my mind, healthcare is, for this reason, also is going to be another one of those sectors to watch over the course of this year, because we'll find opportunities to move money around within different names as names come under pressure, as a new headline comes out about a new class of drugs that's going to be policed differently. I think we'll have an opportunity to add and trim.
Well, I'd like to sort of close out with a sort of question about markets in general. But since we're sort of on the topic of drug pricing and the politically sort of charged subject that it is, mm-hmm. very sort of speculative question, this, I know, but... you know, as I said, we're in the early stages of, yep. of the political cycle. Democrats trying to find their leader. But are there any of those contenders, or do the Democratic Party as a whole, do you think any of their policy mix could threaten U.S. equities or any sectors of the market because they may attempt to, you know, instill their own reverse out some of the policies that Trump has managed to deliver? You know, think about tax cuts, deregulation. Do you think there may be some reversal of that from the Democrats?
I think so. So let's take a step back. So I think within the Democrats, so it looks like it's many people in the field, but I think Biden is probably the front runner, the lead. But Bernie Sanders, you know, he was the element of creative destruction last time, because he didn't bow out gracefully, decided to run sort of a third separate party. And that's really what divided the Democratic ticket. And that, I think, is what handed the Republicans the election. So I think coming into the election this year, it's really important the Democrats really have all their ducks in a row and get everybody behind the one candidate that they managed to bring up. On the Republican side, I'm guessing Trump would run again, would like to do it again. There is a little bit of conspiracy theorist inside of me that says that maybe the Republicans actually figure out a way to get somebody else to be up there instead as a candidate. It will have been 4 years with Trump. It's been fascinating, but perhaps they're looking for to take leadership in a different direction. It's possible. So, you know, it's probably Trump versus somebody else, but it could be individual A versus individual B, yet to be sort of fill in the blank. But if we move down to your question, let's say the Democrats get in. What I don't see them doing is moving hard and fast around rolling back tax law changes. But I do think that they would move much more aggressively around some of the things that have been loosened, which I'm not even sure people talk about it over here, but it's meaningful if you're living in the States. Changes related to the EPA, for example, the Environmental Protection Agency. Changes related to, oil and drilling on, national reserves to bring out oil. You know, loosening standards and those things, especially around the environment, I think the Democrats are really annoyed and would probably move pretty quickly to put that in place. But also putting in new leadership in different departments that, you know, he's nominated people that I think people feel like have been inappropriate and unskilled for some of the positions that they have. I think you'd see a lot of that change back. The corporate tax laws and the personal tax law changes that were done would take more time, would need to be more bipartisan. I don't think it would be wholesale change all over again, just because I think it takes a lot of time. and to really make it stick would have to be bipartisan. Otherwise, every 4 years, the tax law is flipping around. And that...
It's taken a long time to get...
It's taken a long time to get here. And I think while people might like... There's ways to get more money out of companies than raise the headline tax rate number. Because people talk about it. You know, it used to be 35% or whatever. No company paid that. Nobody. Everybody was paying much lesser rate. Because there's lots of loopholes in the tax laws and people just use them.
Okay, so let's round out. Well, I said we'll round out with markets. I just sort of wonder whether there's any other areas of the portfolio. I know I've talked about banks and sort of healthcare. I mean, this is an equity income portfolio. Are there any other areas of the fund that maybe are less talked about that are interesting sources of income?
Well, I think energy is just an area where, you know, it's unusual this year. We've got a lot of sort of M&A activity going on in energy and oil prices are up pretty dramatically. And I think that's an area over the course of this coming year where I would be stunned if we're not going to see more activity within the energy sector, you know, plus or minus, depending on what's going on for us. But I feel like there's more volatility in overall oil prices. And again, because of the M&A transactions that are going on, more assets seem to be in play. So that's a space where I think we could see more opportunities. We talked about healthcare and financials. I think those are kind of the three that...
Okay, great. Well, let's move on to the market then. Of course, a very unfair question. I may ask, you know, whether the S&P is going to be higher or lower by the end of the year. But rather than that specifically, you know, how does the market shape up in terms of valuations to you and given where we looks like we are in the cycle? Not the VR assessment, sorry, that... You know, the end of the cycle isn't imminent, but it's not, couldn't necessarily be a million miles.
No, out. I feel like suspended animation, right? Late cycle. Late cycle. How long are we in late cycle? We're in late cycle. Here we are, late cycle. And so I would say, you know, I would be hard pressed to see why the multiple on the market, overall multiple, should expand from here. And so if I'm here a year from now, or call it the end of the year, and the markets are higher, it would be because I got that wrong. I don't think there's pent-up earnings power, broadly speaking, in the market that people are not already discounting. I think it's much more likely that there's a lot of earnings companies talk about that are back half loaded. And when companies talk about second half or back half loaded earnings, there's always an element of risk to that, obviously. And it's a bit of a wish in some ways. And so my gut says maybe the market will grind a little bit higher, but you know, point to point, we might be a little bit higher from where we are, but I think there's going to be dislocation. And what I am saying by that is the market will have some tough spots, maybe trade down a bit between here and there. It's not going to be a straight line. It's not going to be smooth sailing. Volatility. I mean, expecting, because we're talking about a couple of things. Healthcare, the couple of things we talked about, that can rattle stocks tremendously one way or the other. You know, oil could, you know, might not go back to 30, could drop to 40. For fun, and then that from where it is today, it's 64, 65, that's a lot of dislocation. It was there in December, it can go back again, right? We didn't even talk about technology and the impact in terms of what we're doing, how we're negotiating with China and how that could impact technology stocks. There's lots of different things that I think can cause dislocation between. And, you know, fourth quarter, for example, last year, all of a sudden, everybody looked at all the negatives all at once, and you had a dramatic change in the market price. If instead you took all those sort of those fears and sort of smeared them out over the course of the year, they would cause little sort of slight dislocations in subsectors along the way. And I think we're more likely in that sort of second scenario where different things will percolate, risk will pop out, opportunity in the sector, and then the risk rotates to someplace. The market sees the risk in another part of the market. The risks are there at this kind of level in the multiple. I'm not sure the market's really focused on the risks in the market, but...
So you would expect to be sort of upping activity, I guess.
Yes.
Topping and tailing positions.
Yes.
And, I was sort of hoping for just a sort of a 20% higher.
It's not going to happen.
But your integrity.
I don't think it's going
to
happen.
Shining through there. Thanks so much, Claire, for sparing the time
to
speak to us. Really enjoyed the conversation. To our listeners, let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Bruin Podcast. Leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud. Whatever medium you listen to us through, do let us know. And if there's any topics you want to talk about, again, let us know. But until next time, many thanks for listening.